finding new tactics when battling mosquitoes, an inside view of an immigration detention center, and using military training to protect the environment. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Many remember the battle over insecticides back during the 2016 Zika scare in Miami. Well, a new study from Florida International University now points to perhaps a safer way to battle mosquito populations, larvicide. Plus, thousands of immigrants are in detainment centers across the U.S. seeking asylum. We'll talk with a couple of attorneys from South Florida who recently worked with a group of immigrants in Texas. They're going to share with us how they prepare their clients for the credible fear interview. That's something immigrants have to take when seeking asylum. And imagine the Sierra Club meets Navy SEALs. A new group of conservationists and former military are working together to protect the coral reefs. We'll meet Force Blue. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we are in the depths of mosquito season in South Florida. I don't need to tell some of you, you're attacked constantly. But a new study from FIU shows that we may have the tools to most effectively address the mosquito population. FIU biologist and South Miami Mayor Philip Stoddard examined the spraying of mosquitoes in the areas hardest hit by the Zika virus in Miami back in 2016. He found larvicide, or a chemical that targets baby mosquitoes, was much more effective than traditional insecticide. Now, this strategy has proven effective not just against the mosquitoes that carry the Zika virus, but all varieties, and Stoddard recommends larvicides for private use. The biologist and South Miami mayor joins us now in studio to discuss the research. Mayor Stoddard, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate
it. Pleasure this afternoon.
All right, so how is larvicide reportedly more effective than insecticide in killing mosquitoes?
Well, if you kill the kids, they never hatch out and become the adults. Knocking down the adults really is a game of whack-a-mole, because when you knock them out, they always seem to get replaced by more. And what the data showed from the different attempts at controlling the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes during the Zika outbreaks a couple years ago was that every time the sprays were successful at killing adults, they bounced right back in 2 or 3 days' time.
The population.
The mosquito population came right back. And that's because the mosquito population, turns out, is mostly consists of newly emerged adults. And they're flying around, they're easy to kill, but they're always being replaced from that pool of larvae and pupae that are out there. So going after the kids, going after the larvae, cuts it off at the base and ends the cycle. And the data showed it was effective. That was the most amazing thing.
All right, let's what's the difference between larvicide and insecticide when we're talking about the materials?
Okay, let's brief terminology. So insecticide is anything that kills insects, and insecticides come in sort of three classes. There's adulticides, which kill the adults. There's larvicides, which kill larvae. And then there's some in-between chemicals that prevent the pupae from hatching, developmental inhibitors. And what seemed to be most effective were the larvicides. The least effective turned out to be the adulticides.
And, you know, this also came up a lot, as you remember, back in 2016 with the Zika scare, was the use of NALED. And so what are the risks that we face with insecticides? Do we have the same issue with larvicides?
Okay, so the risks with insecticides, there's a couple of different issues. There's risks to people, there's risks to everything else other than people. And let's start with with people, because everybody's concerned about themselves. The classes of insecticides that make up adulticides, the popular ones these days are the organophosphates, which include NALED, and chlorpyrifos, which is recently being banned in the U.S. for food products. Those are nerve agents developed in World War II for killing people. Turns out they're really effective on insects. The other class we like to use are the pyrethroids. They're synthetic derivatives of the chrysanthemum flower. Pretty effective. There's other classes as well, the neonicotinoids, which are just destroying the honeybee population. All of these have problems. So the organophosphates, like NALED, are very broad spectrum. They kill honeybees. They kill butterflies. They shouldn't be applied near marine environments. The pyrethroids, some of them build up, particularly in the marine environments. And so you worry about the long-term effects on our shrimp populations and the marine ecosystem.
Did you see anything after the 2016 scare and, you know, we're spraying everywhere? Did you see anything that came from that, whether it was damage to the environment, to any other kind of species, or anything that happened to people?
Well, there was a lot of honeybee death. There were lots of photographs I got, just bee massacres.
While we were spraying the Naylin?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's pretty much inevitable. And there was a few people who had some pesticide toxicity, not many. Normally, healthy people are pretty good at detoxifying these particular two groups of pesticides. The folks you want to watch out for, there's a few folks who are sensitive. They get chronic fatigue syndrome if they get any exposure. There's a small segment of people that don't have the enzymes to detoxify them, and those people shouldn't be exposed. And the other group that shouldn't be exposed is pregnant mamas, exactly the same group that we were trying to protect in the Zika situation. So there was an interesting study done in New York State where they're trying to control the mosquitoes that carry West Nile, a different mosquito in the Culex genus. They found that spraying the pyrethroids there was associated with a 25% rise in childhood autism. Now, it's not solid proof, but the association's pretty strong. And so, gosh, you know, here you are trying to protect the kids and you wind up possibly hurting them too. So a safe solution for almost everybody and everything turns out to be the larvicides. And there's a great one that's available commercially and for institutional use. And it's called BTI.
Has any city official from any community in South Florida reached out to, you know, to FIU, to you, to anybody, to look more into, you know, this study, to see what their practices are, to see if maybe they need to change their practices?
Well, certainly during the Nail It outbreak, a lot of people were talking to me about these concerns. And I have to give some credit here. Key West has done a lot of work with BTI, the larvicide, to control Aedes aegypti. And they've really put a lot of time and thought into how this is done, because they had a dengue outbreak that was a big problem down there. And so they got focused on controlling Aedes aegypti far before we did up here in the mainland.
I'm speaking with FIU biologist and South Miami Mayor Philip Stoddard. Stoddard is behind a new study from FIU about the efficacy of spraying mosquitoes with larvicide versus adulticide during the Zika outbreak 2 years ago. Now, the takeaway, targeting the mosquitoes' babies was a way more effective method. So Mayor Stoddard, the Miami Mosquito Control and Habitat Management brought on Dr. William Petrie, I believe is his name, after the Zika outbreak to oversee the department's efforts. How did his expertise in the Cayman Islands guide efforts in Miami?
So Bill Petrie is a longtime expert in mosquito control, and he actually developed a lot of the methods used today for controlling salt marsh mosquitoes. And some of these methods are, in fact, in play down in the Florida Keys. Petrie really knows his science. He's a wonderful guy, very, very educated and smart and very experienced. And when he came on board, I was at a meeting where he said the only really effective tool in our arsenal against Aedes aegypti is the larvicides BTI. So he and I are very much on the same page with respect to the efficacy of this control agent.
There's a unique program going on in your town in South Miami, where you're the mayor, to take on the mosquito population. If I understand this correctly, you're infecting male mosquitoes with a bacterium so they become sterile?
Pretty close.
Okay.
So there's an old technique that was used to control the screwworms, the flies that parasitize cattle. And what they did back then was they sterilized males using radiation, released gazillions of males. And so when the females went out to breed with males, most of the males they found were sterile. And it wiped out screwworms in the United States, very effective. So now there's some new variations on the technique. And the one that's being used in South Miami uses a bacterium called Wolbachia. Half the insects in the world have some kind of Wolbachia in their cells, half the species, and they live in symbiosis with the animal. Turns out our local Aedes aegypti do not have Wolbachia, and there's another biological wrinkle to the story here, and that is if the male has it and the female does not have it, when the gametes, the egg and the sperm, get together, if the sperm has Wolbachia, the new little embryo does not develop. They're cytoplasmically incompatible. So we release male mosquitoes that have Wolbachia. They find the wild females that don't have Wolbachia, and they're better at finding females than we are. They can seek them out. They mate, and the eggs don't develop. So this is even better than targeting the kids. This is targeting reproduction.
So how long has this program been in effect?
So we ran a trial this summer in a section of South Miami, a half mile on a square, and the results were pretty encouraging. In the center of that area, we saw a depression of about 80%.
Is there any concern when we try anything, really, that, you know, we might be creating some new, evolved mosquito or insect that is able to withstand anything we throw at it, and it's just worse than anything we've ever seen? Because we tend to do that, right? As humans, we play with nature, and nature tends out winning, usually.
Well, that's what I want to spend the next few years researching, is exactly that question. If you figure that our local mosquitoes can fit in 15 generations a year, they can outbreed anything you do. So for instance, we say, okay, we want to kill the adults. So when's a safe time to do it? Well, you want to get the mosquitoes before the people wake up. So you spray them at 6 in the morning before everybody's out. What do? You select for the late risers. So the mosquitoes that happen to wake up at 7 o'clock are the ones that populate the cities. And then after that, spraying at 6 doesn't work anymore. And they saw this kind of whack-a-mole game. We've seen it with pesticides. They become resistant to different pesticides. In fact, our Miami Aedes aegypti mosquitoes are very resistant to pyrethroids compared to other mosquitoes around Florida. But they saw it with malaria. They finally figured out how to keep malaria out of the houses where they bit people. So the malaria evolved to wait outside houses to bite people. I mean, it's a marvelous game that evolution plays. So you're absolutely right.
This larvicide, by the way, this is something people could just buy at a store and use around their own home. And you're actually encouraging that of people.
Yeah. So
let's use.
So let's go to this larvicide. So why don't they evolve resistance to the larvicide? And turns out BTI, the soil bacterium, has 4 different toxins. And so the mosquitoes could evolve resistance to one, but the other 3 would get them. And so it's very hard for genetic evolution to get a purchase, to get a foothold on this soil bacterium. So BTI you can buy, and you can get it at Home Depot. You can get it online at Amazon. You can get it over at Galloway Nursery. And there's a commercial product called Mosquito Bits. It's ground up corn cobs, looks like post grape nuts, and it's treated with this bacterium. And you throw a few grains into your bromeliads, every single one. You throw it into the cat dish if you got a water dish outside. If you've got potted plants, you can use it indoors. You can safely eat this stuff because it doesn't affect people. In fact, it doesn't affect butterflies. It doesn't affect most insects. But mosquitoes are one of the few it does affect.
The battle against mosquitoes is it's a fascinating conversation to have. And I still got you here. Before we finish up, I want to switch things up a little bit because I want to focus on some issues going on in your town. You're here, and I have to ask you this, but there is a controversy going on right now in South Miami. There's an investigation into actions that you took against Stephen Cody in South Miami, in a South Miami Commission meeting earlier this year. He's arguing that he was silenced in the meeting, and this violates his right to be heard under the Citizen Bill of Rights for South Miami-Dade. Please, first of all, explain to us why you refused to listen to Cody. Why didn't you let him talk at a meeting?
Well, Mr. Cody was a paid political operative. His only business in South Miami was as a paid political operative. And under at least the interpretation of the regulations by our city attorney, if you are paid to represent an issue before the council, you have to register as a lobbyist. Mr. Cody had not registered as a lobbyist. So I asked the city attorney if he had to register before speaking. The city attorney said he did. The commission discussed it. The commission concluded that indeed he did have to register as a lobbyist. And it was a different member of the city commission who told him, I'm sorry, Mr. Cody, you have to register before you can speak.
What is the, help me understand the right to be heard under the South Miami Citizen Bill of Rights?
Well, this is countywide. And if you are, quote, an interested person, unquote, you have the right to address the local elected body before they vote on a matter. What's an interested person? It's not somebody with an intellectual curiosity. Under Florida state law, an interested person is somebody who holds a material interest or financial interest in that municipality. So if you're a taxpayer, if you're a property owner, if you own a business, you have a material interest. Likewise, if you're a paid lobbyist, you have a material interest. But if you're just some random person who has curiosity or wishes to go speak somewhere, you're not legally an interested person.
You already knew who he was and when he was stepping up, because I'm wondering if, like, when he came up the first time, I think it was in January, did you know who he was and what he wanted to say?
Well, I just gotten a robocall from him a few hours earlier. And so he'd sort of announced his what he was talking about there. But he began to speak, and he was he made it clear what he was going to be talking about. And, you know, this again, this comes back to following the advice of the city attorney. So when I consulted with the city attorney could have said, Mayor Stoddard, please, you know, let him speak. Or the city attorney could have said, no, Mr. Cody, you have to register as a lobbyist. So we had the discussion with the city attorney, and the city attorney said he had to register. Now, he could have done that. He could have gone and registered the next day with a clerk, come back to the next meeting as a registered lobbyist, and he would have had the city attorney's permission to speak at the meeting. And I have to rely on the advice of my city attorney. That's what it comes down to.
If he registers as a lobbyist, then he would be allowed to speak.
Absolutely. Well, whether I like it or not. You know, if you're an interested person, then you have the right. And I don't have to like what you say. Nobody does. But you have to have standing. And if you're paid to be speaking, then you have to register.
I appreciate you answering those questions. Again, talking with FIU biologist in South Miami, Mayor Philip Stoddard. A new study, because we were talking about this new study from FIU, talks about the efficacy of spraying mosquitoes with larvicide versus adulticide. Interesting conversation about maybe a new way to attack, you know, mosquito populations here in South Florida, because I know a lot of people were worried about some of these adulticides, and of course a lot of people were angry about the whole NALID thing. So a study that we're going to keep looking at, and I know that, as you said, you want to keep studying, I guess, this back and forth between humans and mosquitoes. So I definitely want to have you back so we can figure out where that battle is and what we can do next. Mayor Stoddard, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, a conversation with a couple of South Florida lawyers who recently spent time in Texas giving legal advice to immigrant fathers who were recently reunited with their children in detention centers. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the detention of undocumented immigrants remains a hotly contested issue in the U.S. In the weeks following the Trump administration's announcement that it was ending the separation of undocumented children from their families, questions remain about what legal rights are available for those held in detention. Back in July, five attorneys from the Miami-based law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney traveled to Carnes, Texas. Over the course of several days, they provided pro bono legal advice to immigrant mothers who were there without their children and fathers who had recently been reunited with their kids. Gina Polo and Christine Alden are immigration attorneys for Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, and they join me now in studio to share their experiences on that trip. Gina, Christine, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
All right, so you both have been practicing immigration law for some time now, so you've been to detention centers previously to this, but tell me, start by describing, you know, the facility in Carnes. I mean, tell me about when you got there and what was going on.
Okay, so when we got to Carnes Detention Center.
And I've been mispronouncing, I apologize. Carnes, thank you.
And I wasn't meaning to correct you.
No, please
it's
do.
Carnes. When we arrived, we weren't really sure what to expect. When the trip was planned, we thought we were going to be meeting with mothers and their children. When we got there, it was a few days after the reunification of the fathers and the their sons. So when we arrived, we were greeted with fathers and sons that we were immediately preparing for their credible fear interviews and working on their asylum applications.
And where, by the way, I mean, where is this? Was it easy to get to this detention center? Tell me a little bit about that experience.
No, it's about an hour south of San Antonio. So the five of us piled into an SUV and drove down there. And the first day, somehow we typed in the wrong address and we ended up on a dirt road. A coyote crossed in front of us. So definitely a little bit of a remote location from any major city.
Is that typical for detention centers to be remote?
In our experience, at least immigration centers, they're not typically in the middle of cities. They are, you know, here in Miami, the Chrome Detention Center is on 182nd Avenue, so it's, you know, a little bit far out. And when it was built, it was even more remote than it is now.
And Gina, and both of you were preparing detained immigrants for credible fear interviews. Tell me, what is a credible fear interview?
So it's an interview that the applicants have with an asylum officer, where the asylum officer basically determines whether they have a plausible case or a realistic basis by which to obtain asylum. So they have to talk to the officer, explain why they fear returning to their home country, what happened to them there, and what it is that's the basis of their claim.
Where in the process does that interview take place? When a person arrives, they're taken to this center. I mean, at what point is that interview done?
It's done relatively soon to their arrival in the United States. I believe that there is that it's supposed to be done within, I think it's 7 days of getting to the United States. But it's done. It's the first step, essentially, in the asylum process when they get here.
How long does a fear interview take? How long can it go?
It depends on the officer and what the person is claiming and how long it takes to explain it. Some of the people that we met with, their interviews were a couple of hours. Sometimes they'll continue the case. So if they have an interview where they need more information or there's something else that needs to be discussed, they'll continue it and then pick it up again the next day.
Christine, when you're talking with these folks, what types of information are you looking for in your conversations with immigrants to help them in this credible fear, interview that they have to do?
So the first thing that we would do is actually try to establish trust with the people that we met with, because basically every step of the way, they have had obstacles to get to this point. So we need to make sure they know first that we're not immigration. And so when we went, we intentionally dressed down. We tried to make them comfortable. My approach was, I've been an immigration attorney for more than 2 decades. There's nothing you tell me that is going to shock me, to try to make them comfortable and that I'm here to help you to make sure you have the best chance possible of getting through the credible fear.
Many of these
interview.
People don't even speak English.
Right. So I worked through an interpreter because I don't speak Spanish. A lot of these people, because they're from rural areas of Guatemala, they don't even speak Spanish. They speak what we call rare languages, like Canjibal. But there were interpreters available to us. During the time there, we would listen to their story. And then at the end of our meeting, my approach was to tell them, okay, this is what's important. This is what you should talk about first when you're asked in this credible fear interview. Why did you leave your country? Because we have to help them kind of understand how they have to articulate their claim.
You know, I'd imagine, and I'm just trying to put myself in their shoes, but I really can't. I can't truly understand what they're going through is, you know, they have probably gone through who knows what just to get here. And they get here, not only do they not speak the language, whatever the perceptions they had of America, but they don't know our system. They don't know what happens. They get detained and they get put into some detainment center. I mean, what do you tend to see? What do you tend to hear from them about their experience and how they try to at least make sense of all of this?
Yeah. So they have obstacles every step of the way. You're correct. It's very difficult for them to even get to the border. They're already risking their lives to travel through all the different countries to get to the United States. Once they get here, we were given stories that when they applied at the port of entry, where they said, I'm afraid to go back to my home country, they were told there was no more asylum, that they couldn't come in. So then a lot of them either have snuck across the border, they've then been detained, they've been separated from their families. They've already gone through horrendous violence in their home countries that's uncontrolled by the governments where they come from. And then when they come to the United States, then they're traumatized a second time by being separated from their families and being detained. So basically every step of the way, they've gone through obstacles. Some of the people I met with, they were showing me, I did meet with some women also that I prepared. They had scars all over their bodies where they'd been attacked with knives. So that's the kind of violence that we were looking at. It was based on gang violence. A lot of it was domestic violence.
How do you build that rapport? I mean, I can understand the idea of not showing up in a full suit or formally dressed so that they don't, you know, aren't intimidated. But that's not enough, right? I mean, what is it you say to even get them to loosen up and feel more comfortable with you?
Try to make them feel as comfortable as possible. You have to be really patient. Sometimes when you initially start to meet with them, it's hard to bring out those facts. And some of the meetings I had, I know we were supposed to be as efficient as possible, but you did have to take a couple of hours to really get this out of them. And the biggest concern I have is that there are a lot of people in that situation that have never had any access to counsel because, as Gina mentioned, these centers are in remote and rural locations, and only 14% of detained immigrants do have access to counsel at any point. So, you know, the concern is if it's hard for us to get them to trust them and they haven't had any meetings ahead of time of their credible fear, it's really the system is against them when they go forward for that credible fear interview. And another thing we noticed while we were there is those credible fear interviews are not done in person. They were done over the phone by the asylum adjudicators.
So the interview they have to go through to prove that they should get asylum is not a one-on-one in-person interview?
And I don't know if it's always like that, but at least while we were there at Carnes, the people who were going through their credible fear interviews were not interviewed in person. And this is their shot to be able to go into the next step of the process to claim asylum.
Does that hurt them or maybe even help them in any way that it's done by phone?
I believe it hurts because it's hard to judge credibility when you can't see the person face to face.
Gina, did you work with any children detainees at Carnes?
We spoke to some of the children in terms of preparing asylum applications and talking with them and their fathers about the experiences that they'd had coming into the United States, why they were here, what their fears were. So there were a lot of kids that were there with their dads while we were there.
What is the process when you're talking about children? And I don't know, depending on their age, can a child go through, a credible fear interview?
Well, that's a very hot topic right now. So there is some litigation that's being put forth to argue basically that children can apply for their own asylum claims. And we had the opportunity to meet with some of the kids while we were there and try to prepare them for their own asylum interviews and their credible fear interviews while we were there.
Yeah, you both have been doing this for a while, but did you see anything at Carnes that surprised you or anything that you haven't seen before or heard before?
You know, for us, or for me at least, it was very eye-opening to see the fathers there with their kids. You know, we practice immigration law. We've been practicing for a long time, but this was a completely different and new situation. So it was very emotional. It was very difficult to see these fathers who had been reunited with their kids just, you know, a day or two prior. And some of them, even when they were walking around, were always, you know, had their hands on their shoulder of their son or whatnot, just out of fear of being separated from them again. And you can see that with their children as well. And there was one gentleman that I met with who had not gotten credible fear. So they have the opportunity to request that it be reheard by an immigration judge. And what we were talking about before, about the preparation and the importance of it, this gentleman had been denied credible fear. And when he told me his story, I couldn't believe it. So I remember I asked him, did you explain all of this to the officer? And he said, no. Well, why not? Because it was, you know, we had been there for 2 hours and I thought that maybe he would get upset that I was taking too long to explain to him what was going on. So the importance of having somebody to advise you beforehand, you know, it's essential to give these people any kind of fair opportunity of presenting their cases. These are people that sometimes have very low level of education.
You know, in a normal law enforcement situation, people have a right to an attorney. Is that the case with immigrants?
It's not, because immigration proceedings, even after credible fear, when you're in removal proceedings before an immigration judge, it's a civil process. So there is no right to counsel.
I'm talking with Gina Polo and Christine Alden. They are immigration attorneys and partners at the Miami-based law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. They recently returned from a pro bono trip to an immigration detention center in Carnes, Texas, where they provided legal advice to immigrants facing credible fear interviews. As we've been hearing, what these interviews are, it's a very important part of the process if someone is looking for asylum into the United States. As you had mentioned just a second ago, that's a lot of these interviews, as far as we know, Christine, are done by phone. I wondered, what are the steps right after the interview is over? Usually what happens at that point? Is it a quick decision on what may happen to these folks, or is there some other step?
So we were told they were supposed to get decisions in 7 days. That wasn't happening in practice, I think, because of the volume, but it is approximately 7 days. If they have been found not to have met the credible fear standard, they can appeal to the immigration judge. In the location we were at, the closest immigration judge was an hour north in San Antonio. And what we found troubling is there was no effort to take the applicant to the immigration court to appear in person before the immigration judge. That was not done by phone, but it was done by video.
It sounds as if there isn't an advocate, whether it's an attorney or someone else, to speak up, then these people are going to be lost in the system. Because, I mean, I don't know, what's your experience? Do you get the sense that immigration officials are open with them to tell them about, well, you have this option too, if you want, or this option?
Yeah, our concern is for a lot of this, there's nobody really on their side, and they are kind of set up to fail. Without us there, I don't know how they know, and I don't know how it's ever found out how many people have not made it to the credible fear. I'm not sure, also not sure as to the people who are turned away at the border, if they all make it across or if they don't. So it is something that's a problem, and especially because a low percentage of detained immigrants who have access to counsel. It is definitely one of the issues. You know, one of the things I feel is that these people shouldn't even be detained in the first place. It's not a choice of should they be detained together as a family or apart. They shouldn't be detained. There are options for alternate to detention programs, but the government has to explain to them, you know, these are your responsibilities. This is when you need to check in. This would be a lot more humane. It would be a lot less expensive than paying private prison out of taxpayer money to keep these people detained. And the statistics show that these people do want to report. They do want to go forward with their asylum case. They just need to know what their responsibilities are.
Gina, is it also, do these folks need to have attorneys, or can it be anyone, even if they don't have a background in immigration law, to be that voice to speak up for any of these folks?
It definitely does not have to be an immigration attorney. The group that we went down with from our firm, of the five of us, only two, Christine and myself, are immigration attorneys. The other three are commercial litigation attorneys. So we just prepared them ahead of time. We gave them the law, the regulations, the articles. We talked to them about it. And when I was there, I met with a retired attorney who goes down there for the past 2.5 years every Wednesday and volunteers his time to help this population that really needs it so desperately. It doesn't have to be an attorney at all. In fact, it can be, you know, just somebody that's interested in helping these people out and giving them the best shot.
I also believe that you both worked with a nonprofit group while you were in Carnes, and they've been one of the key organizations in the reunification of immigrant families.
Yes, and it's an organization called Raices.
And so tell me a little bit about how critical they are in that process, again, to continue to bring families back together, or at least to help these folks when they find themselves in these centers.
They're essential. I mean, I was so impressed with the work that these people do, that they're there every day, day in and day out, listening to some pretty horrific things and really doing their best to help this population. They, you know, these people have been through quite an ordeal coming into the United States and being separated from their children. And I was really struck with how kind all of these volunteers were, where if a father had to wait, you know, 20 minutes or half an hour to see somebody, they were thanking them for being so patient and waiting to see one of the volunteers. The work they do is really, really amazing.
Let me finish with this. A question for both of you is, I mean, you've been doing this for a while now, and I wonder how that shaped, I guess, your views on this issue. And you think about what's been going on the last couple of years on this topic. I don't know. I mean, you know, and again, whatever this experience maybe has added to that, but, you know, everything that you've experienced in your career, you know, working with immigrants, you know, how has that shaped you as a person and your views on this issue? I want to know from both of you.
In terms of the career and working with immigrants, for me, it's made me much more thankful and much more appreciative. And you really put things in perspective, because you talk to people who quite literally have risked their lives, the lives of their children, to come to the United States. You hear these stories of what they've endured, and it really just makes you appreciative of what it is that you have. And at the same time, makes you really aware of the responsibility that you have when you go and you help them, how important the work is that you do on an everyday basis.
And Christine, what about you? And I wondered also, you know, your thoughts on just the environment, political environment we're in, and on this is such a hot topic right now, in a bad way.
Yeah. So as an immigration attorney, I feel like this is one of the best things I've ever done and something that I'm the most proud of in my 20 years of practice. I look at this as, you know, what do we have to do to solve this problem and the bigger picture, and want to use that motivation to go out and speak out and encourage others to do so. I have been really vocal about wanting an independent judiciary for the immigration courts because it is all under the Attorney General and it's not independent. I really would like to see alternates to detention, as I talked about earlier. And also, I would like to make sure that there's more access to counsel and more due process in these cases. And I think that that is something we really need to get out to the American public, that this is happening here in the United States.
Christine Alden and Gina Polo, they are immigration attorneys and partners at the Miami-based law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. Again, they're sharing their story of a recent trip they took to Karnes, Texas, at a immigration detention center there, and some of the things that they saw and experienced and some of the folks that they helped. Gina, Christine, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet a group that uses former military forces to combat conservation issues. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the coral off the coast of Florida is in trouble. We've known that. It's not just coral bleaching, though. There's another culprit, a disease that's been attacking the coral these last few years, and it's impacted coral from Martin County down to the Keys. Now, there's a group trying to come to the rescue of these coral. It's Force Blue. It's a group made up of former military-trained combat divers with a new mission, protect the environment. Jim Ritterhoff started the group not only to solve the problems with saving the coral, but also helping veterans, giving them a new mission in life. Well, joining me now in studio is Mr. Ritterhoff. Mr. Ritterhoff, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
It's great to be here, Lewis. Thank you.
Also joining us, one of the members of Force Blue, Air Force Sergeant and Silver Star recipient, Roger Sparks. Mr. Sparks, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, Jim, let me start with this. I mean, combat meets conservation, but when and how did Force Blue become a thing?
Yeah, well, Lewis, the genesis for the idea really happened about 3 years ago. I have a dear friend who Roger also knows, who Roger actually trained as a recon Marine, a guy named Rudy Reyes, who's a friend of mine, as I said, who had been having some issues in assimilating back after all these combat tours and all these years spent in the military to civilian life. His transition was difficult. And I ran into him. I saw that he was struggling. Coincidentally, I was going on a dive trip the following week down to visit another friend of ours, a guy named Keith Sam, who at the time managed a resort, a scuba diving resort. And very long story short, we spent a week diving with Rudy, and he came out of the water a changed guy. He said, you know, this has done more for me than any therapy, any rehab, anything I've been through since I left the military. And it wasn't just the experience of diving. It was starting to understand the ecosystem that exists underwater and the threat that's posed to it. So Rudy immediately said, you know, we got to expose more of my guys to this. I had been working to try to, you know, as a communications professional, to try to raise awareness for what's happening. And we sort of had the idea, hey, maybe we can serve, you know, two purposes here. We can bring guys back and give them a new mission, which is something that they're really lacking. And at the same time, we can use them to raise awareness, you know, amongst a whole group of people that may not listen to just marine scientists.
And yeah, I wanted to get a sense of what is the mission exactly? How do you describe the mission to people?
Well, we say very simply that we're on a mission to preserve and restore. And that means two things. It means we want to preserve, obviously, our marine resources that are being threatened the world over. And we want to restore them wherever possible and work to do that. But we also want to preserve and restore our veterans. I think as civilians, Hollywood kind of conditions us to believe that things like PTSD and the suicide epidemic that we hear about amongst our veteran community are all the result of things that have happened to them in their service. And while that certainly plays a part, a lot of it is just a sense of coming back and not having a mission anymore. You can't send people to ask people to spend a decade of their life at war and then come back and say, hey, you know, sit in a cubicle for the rest of your life. So that's really what we're about. We call ourselves a mission therapy program for our veterans.
Mr. Sparks, you were recon Marine and an Air Force pararescueman. You were in the forces for over a quarter of a century. I mean, what kind of missions and deployments were you on in that time?
Wow, that's a long story to get into. But yeah, I joined the military right out of high school, and definitely romanticized special operations. And I just wanted to see the world and see how bad, you know, things could be. And you know, just be careful what you ask for, because you'll see it. But yeah, I did 12 years with Marine Recon, and basically transitioned from that and got into pararescue. And I retired this last September. You know, basically, it's very difficult to go from like the surreal world of not only, you know, like a military combat veteran, but from the career field of special operations. It's such a distinct, you know, experience. And it's just very hard to, I guess, you know, assimilate back into, you know, attempting to be a productive citizen in any way. And it's a very isolating experience to kind of remove yourself from that brotherhood, you know, or that camaraderie that you've been a part of for, like you said, you know, over 25 years. And it's difficult because, you know, it's just somewhat of a consumer society, you know, this, that strip mall recreating itself every 5 miles. And I, you know, I truly feel, you know, with a lot of the experiences that we have, specifically, you know, speaking for myself and my peer group, you know, guys that have made a career out of special operations and have significant combat experience, it's very difficult to kind of come home to yourself. And, you know, I truly feel that to heal ourselves, we have to heal other people and, you know, the planet. You know, it's just, you know, to focus on doing virtuous things definitely helps us come home to ourselves. You know, it makes it, it gives our pain purpose.
How did you find Force Blue?
You know, through a bit of serendipity. You know, I had a pretty good career as a, you know, as a reconnaissance Marine. And one of the very fascinating, brilliant men that I trained, I spent a large portion of that time being like a cadre or instructor for Marine reconnaissance guys. And one of the great men that I had the opportunity to train was Rudy Reyes. And we were very, very, you know, dear friends. And I basically left the Marine Corps and I went into pararescue just to kind of broaden my horizons a little bit. Our experiences kind of diverged there, and out of the blue and out of a really crazy sense of circumstances, I got into tattooing. But I'd been, you know, we'd kept in touch, Rudy and myself, and he was always doing some crazy stuff. He got involved in Hollywood. You know, like I said, he's such a dynamic personality. Hollywood just jumped on top of him, you know. And I got involved in tattooing, and it's a very crazy story, but I allow serendipity and synchronicity to really affect me. You know, I try to, you know, live by taking risk.
Does Force Blue, you know, I guess, help you in that adaptation, or just is it just another mission? What does that do for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. A lot of people think that, you know, there's, you know, these Wounded Warrior programs where there's therapy diving. You know, this is not a therapy program. You know, this is a program where we take, you know, special operations combat vets, and we basically pair them with the A-lister conservationists on planet Earth. And so that's a powerful tool. You know, I mean, I think all of us would agree that, you know, dichotomy has power. And those are two pretty strong, you know, polarities, you know, the conservation community and then special operations.
And some of those operations have taken place like when Key Largo, Puerto Rico, and places like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, so at first we didn't really know how it was going to work, but you know, these A-lister conservationists, you know, Coral Restoration Foundation, Reef, you know, just all these organizations, Moat. But what we found is we have so many similarities. You know, we're dedicated to mission, we're passionate about what we do, and we're selfless in the things that we're doing. And so all of those things combined, we're really just, you know, functioning in the same capacity. We want to use our lives and our abilities to affect things in a virtuous way around us, you know.
Jim, let me ask you about this mm-hmm. mission right now, this current mission, because I mentioned it at the beginning, is the fact that there's a threat to the coral. And it's not just the coral bleaching that we've seen. There's another threat going on right now, and this is an important mission right now. But just briefly, what can you tell us about what's going on?
Well, I can tell you what, you know, from a Force Blue perspective, we're hoping to get involved with as far as the overall issue that's affecting the Florida coral reef tract. We learned when Roger went through the training, which was about a year ago, we immediately came down to South Florida after Hurricane Irma, did some restoration work in the Keys, working with NOAA, CRF. And then from there, we went to Puerto Rico, worked with the Ocean Conservancy, NOAA again. So we realized we have the training to do this, and we can actually make a difference, right? But we realized we need more guys. We need to do another training to get even more special operations guys on board.
How many do you have right now?
We have 6 Team One members. We have we just came back, drove up from the Keys this morning, where we're training our second team of 6, Team Two, right? But the goal, we've been in conversations with the state of Florida through the department, the DEP, who we know because we were down here in last October, about being sort of the special operations in water lead on what is going to be, you know, I think the most historic and largest conservation, you know, rescue, restoration, and preservation attempt of a coral reef ever made. And we're training our guys here in Key Largo now to be able to jump in and help in that. What that's going to, you know, exactly entail, I think everybody's still working on. The disease that you mentioned, there's a lot of unknowns about it. All that is known is that it's moving very quickly and it's very destructive. So techniques, trainings, things that have never been implemented before are actually being worked on now. Scientists are working on. We're just hoping we can get in the water and aid in that. And, you know, everything from, you know, doing the restoration work that we've done to basically smoke jumping into, you know, the disease and trying to stem it before, you know, it just ravages the entire reef tract.
You know, real quickly before we finish up, Mr. Sparks, tell me real quickly, I'd imagine, I'm not putting words in your mouth, you tell me, is I know from other people I've spoken to that there was always a sense of pride of service, but how do you talk about this now with people?
Yeah, it's definitely a can of worms to get into with people, but again, you know, I just look at it as you know, healing others, you know, and the planet to heal ourselves. You know, I think that I get into it with people. I try to kind of breach the mechanism of, hey, you know, it's like this is not a therapy program. It gives us mission. You know, we basically get called up and we go work. It's not fun. You know, just like after the hurricanes last year, we came up and we're working directly with NOAA with no power, unfavorable dive conditions, you know, and, you know, no AC, you know, in, you know, Key Largo down here, you know, working. And it's work, but it's something that, you know, we're, you know, I've spent 25 years working in austere conditions. And so it's kind of like a homecoming, but, it's basically just this new program that allows, myself and men from my peer group to continue doing something, that's virtuous. You know, it's difficult. It's definitely a can of worms to get in to try to explain it. You know?
Yeah. And Jim, just real quickly, in 30 seconds, I mean, what do you see Force Blue becoming in the future? I mean, is it just local, regional? Could this be a global thing?
No, in fact, we actually, two of our, you know, our first 12 divers now are from the UK. One's British Royal Marine, one's a special boat service veteran. But no, I do think it has the potential to become an international a movement. What I want to emphasize, though, for the people of Florida particularly, is that our goal over the next 3 years is to move our entire operation down here and to be 100% dedicated to solving this problem with the Florida coral reef tract, because it really is that important. I don't think people understand that we're talking about the third largest coral reef system on the planet, and that, you know, the only coral reef system in the continental United States. So it's really a now or never situation, and we're just we're delighted to be a part of it, and, you know, hope we can make our mark for the people of Florida.
Again, I've been talking with Sergeant Roger Sparks and Jim Ritterhoff. They are part of Force Blue, an organization teaming up former Special Operations Forces to take part in conservation missions right now, focusing on the problems facing the coral reefs here in South Florida. We're going to do a quick video after this, so you can check us out on Facebook, so don't go anywhere. But that's the program. Gentlemen, I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Sparks, thank you so much for your service. I appreciate it. Well, that's the program for today. I'm Lewis Hernandez. We'll talk to you on Thursday.